My name is Tom Jackson, and I am talking with Norman Solomon today. Norman Solomon is a nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics. He's the founder of and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts. And his columns have appeared in a tremendous amount of places, even mainstream media like The Washington Post, LA Times, USA Today. He has appeared on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, CNN, even Fox News. And his latest book is called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman Solomon, thanks for being with us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Right from the get-go with the title of this book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, I can hear neocons and their supporters making that sort of grumbling noise that they make when they're you know, confronted with a statement that they know somewhere deep down they can't really argue with, but of course they want to. You know, it's that sort of sort of thing. This is a great title and a great book. Can you give listeners a sort of outline of what the book is about?
Well, it's really about looking for patterns of the last five decades. And if neocons wanted to grumble about it, they'd have to acknowledge, and maybe this would make them less upset, that it's not in any way a partisan book and deals with ways in which presidents of both major political parties have used these mechanisms of media manipulation to build agendas for war. And while we've had all these changes in media technology and to some extent style in the last several decades, I found looking back from the early 1960s going through the present day, there's not a heck of a lot new under the sun, that there are some boilerplate themes, they're, so to speak, drums that are beat on time after time. And when the White House is filled with people who are dead set about going to war, they find ways to get the reporters and pundits on board, and the rest is bloody history.
There's a little bit of the same thing going on with your book as with, say, Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, and that's that upon reading it, we see that the problems that we have today with the administration that's in the White House are actually not so new or unique. They may be magnified a bit in some respects, but they're not. They're really things that have been going on for quite some time.
There is continuity, and that's, I think, extremely important. On the one hand, people may react by feeling, well, gee, this has been so bad for so long. How can we change things? Wouldn't that be a discouraging sort of a realization? But I think that on the whole, we're much better equipped to deal with the current realities if we can put them in context, because a scam, when it keeps being run, is less effective when we can see the pattern. And so, just to give an example, this whole argument about not being willing to, quote, cut and run is not a new argument at all. And it was used by Lyndon Johnson. The same phrase was used, that you can't cut and run from Vietnam, just as President George W. Bush is using the same phrase about how you can't cut and run from Iraq. But a lot of the fallacies were present in both situations, and often they can be more quickly and clearly discerned when we look at a situation that, through the light of some decent rendition of history, we can see clearly that a war based on lies, with the U.S. troops engaged in warfare in a country where clearly most people do not want them, is just headed for disaster by any definition. And I think seeing that can be very helpful in clearing away a lot of fog about purported responsibility that the U.S. government has, we're told, to keep troops in Iraq.
Well, I do want to go back in a few minutes to the whole, you know, credibility thing and we can't cut and run. But first, I'd like to go through a few chapters in your book and just have you talk about what you focus on in those chapters and bring it up to date with the current U.S. occupation of Iraq. And the first one I'd like to talk about, chapter 3, is called Our Leaders Would Never Tell Us Outright Lies.
Well, that's a popular mythology, and often it comes in the form that Oh, yes. This prior president, Nixon or Johnson or whoever, told flagrant, arrogant lies. But the current president wouldn't do that. It's kind of an exceptionalism of the present in relation to the past. It's also a kind of internalization of the idea, well, that was then, but this is now. And in fact, lying is quite continuous in terms of presidents who want to go to war. And I have to say, this was very striking to me because when I went back from the early 1960s onward, I would have thought the, you know, depending on how one defines a war, the 8 or 10 major U.S. wars, certainly major for the people who fought in them and died in them, you would think that the law of averages would have at least some of those wars be based on fundamental truthfulness and not be based on some essential elements of deception. And yet, the law of averages are confounded because every single war from the invasion of the Dominican Republic and the buildup in Vietnam to the present war in Iraq that the U.S. has been involved in and instigated, which is to say the same thing in the last several decades, every war of those has been based on fundamentally deception coming out of the White House. And sure, there were some truths thrown in, but outright lies have been fundamental, including the lie of omission. And Aldous Huxley wrote in the beginning of the introduction to Brave New World, he said, you know, lies are powerful, but even more powerful is silence about truth, which is a form of lie. As I quote Pentagon general saying during the Gulf War to a reporter from Newsday, we lie by not telling you things, and that is part of the process. So you go from the Gulf of Tonkin to the weapons of mass destruction claims where Cheney and Bush said that to a certainty there were WMDs in Iraq. Lies have been just essential to the war-making process.
It does seem as though a really significant percentage of the U.S. population is willing to give every new leader, every new administration, even if it's filled with some of the people from the past, a clean slate. And I would imagine that's something that you have thought about and looked into. Why do you think that is, that there's this really consistent wiping of the slate with so many people in our country?
Well, you know, the corporate system, which spans through the military constituency, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, now is so the media are so corporatized we could call it the military-industrial media complex, is not loyal to any one individual. And in fact, it's quite useful to render some of them expendable. I mean, I. Lewis Libby's being dangled out hung out to dry, so to speak. And I think that it's, you know, it's quite possible that Dick Cheney may be hung out to dry, and he may suddenly discover that he needs to spend a lot more time with his family, and there'll be a vacancy in the vice president's office. The system, if you will, is not dedicated to any individual, and they are expendable, and all of them, of course, will pass from the scene. And so this notion that we're starting anew, which has been thematic, really, of most presidencies, is very useful. You notice that Wall Street doesn't pack up and leave, and neither does the CIA. These are institutions that have their institutional processes that continue. It's about profits. It's about the massive wealth being accumulated by a relatively few number of people. When you look at the Chevron and Exxon Mobil and so forth, profits, you see just billions and billions of dollars in profits being racked up while our tax dollars are being squandered to slaughter people in Iraq and bring about so many deaths of the Americans sent largely by economic draft to do that horrible work. And that is a process that continues beyond any individual. So when we have a new president in early 2009, no doubt we will be told that it is new beginnings. In the book, I quote I.F. Stone, the great journalist, at the time of the inauguration, the first inauguration of President Richard Nixon, saying that the presidents make us suckers. I'm paraphrasing here, but the presidents, the incoming ones, make us suckers for our hopes at the inaugurations. And he was, as usual, quite prophetic in that case.
Chapter 6 is called This Is Not at All About Oil or Corporate Profits. That's something that I have certainly heard in bird-dogging my four Republican representatives in the House and Senate. And, of course, we've all heard people in the Bush administration talk about it. Can you tell us about that?
There is often a lot of vilification of any who raise the question of corporate profits in wartime. I think it's quite remarkable. If you go back to World War II, then-Senator Harry Truman chaired hearings on Capitol Hill about war profiteering, and that was in the middle of World War II, a great true menace to the United States if the victory had gone to the other side, and yet this is a situation where there was willingness to look at war profiteering. There's very little willingness now beyond the rhetorical denunciations of, you know, Halliburton or Bechtel or whatever because of closeness to Bush administration officials like Dick Cheney. But what bothers me most is the stuff that we don't hear about, that despite the denials and aspersions against those who raise these issues, if you look at, say, the annual reports, as I did, of Pentagon contracting companies, and I don't call them defense contractors, I call them military contractors, whatever the size, you find an extreme reliance on the process of profit-taking from contracts with the so-called Defense Department. So when I went through the annual reports, whether it was Orbit International Corporation, which is a small company, or Engineered Support Systems, which has about $500 million in sales as of last year, and then you have the mammoth Northrop Grumman with over $26 billion in revenues in the last couple of years annually. You've got this constant acknowledgement in their annual reports that they are depending on war. They're depending on, well, here's wording from Orbit International Corporation, we are heavily dependent upon military spending as a source of revenues and income. Accordingly, any substantial future reductions in overall military spending by the U.S. government could have a material adverse effect on our sales and earnings. Well, this is true of these contractors. And then you go to questions about oil. Does anybody seriously think that if there were not a drop of oil under the sand in Iraq instead of an estimated 112 billion barrels, that we would have U.S. troops there today?
Chapter 12 is called This Is a Necessary Battle in the War on Terrorism. Of course, almost mantra that's repeated by Bush and Bush administration officials. Tell us about that chapter.
It is a mantra, and the way in which it has dominated the news media and the spin for war has been really oftentimes overwhelming in the political arena. I think it's worth noting, as I do in the book, that this is not a new theme. It has just been enormously pumped up. In 1964, when there were efforts with a proposal from the French government to reconvene the Geneva Conference to find some kind of peaceful solutions to the war in Vietnam and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, the response from Lyndon Johnson was that, and I'm quoting here, the proposal would, quote, ratify terror, unquote. And in fact, there was a theme in U.S. media coverage that the U.S. war in Vietnam was opposing terrorism. And so anytime there are guerrillas involved in fighting the U.S. occupying force, they have been called terrorists in the U.S. media. But now that is obviously, as you say, a mantra. And I, in the book, raise the question about whether we're going to have a single standard of terrorism, and for that matter, human rights. Will we apply the same standard? On 9/11, when the horrible tragedy happened, the crime of 9/11 occurred, Colin Powell was in Latin America, and he immediately issued a statement condemning those who he said would destroy buildings and kill people for political purposes. Well, that is something that various successive U.S. administrations have done in terms of, for instance, killing, according to the Pentagon, 100,000 people during 6 weeks in the Gulf War in early 1991, a war that Colin Powell was, of course, made a hero out of as a general, as a leader, as a, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so forth. And yet, when you look at the questions that were raised of Colin Powell right after the Gulf War, he was asked about the statistics of how many Iraqis had been killed, and he said, and I quote this in the book, that's not a number I'm very interested in. And in fact, the top U.S. officials have shown they're not interested in the people who have been killed, the numbers, who they were, by U.S. firepower. And the rationale is that we're good and we're now fighting terrorism. But the reality is, when civilians are predictably killed by U.S. Weaponry and military actions, that is experienced by them as terror. They are being terrorized from their vantage point. And for us to say, well, that doesn't matter because we know different, because our intentions are good, it really doesn't get very far. It's not very convincing in the world avenue. I also quote the New York Times journalist Chris Hedges in his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He talks about how killing civilians is often presented as a way of sending a message, and he recounts that the bombing of Vietnam by the United States was described by then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara as a way to send a message, as he put it, to the communist rulers in Hanoi. And Hedges, who covered the Gulf War for the New York Times, comments, not in the Times, but in his book, that this message is this idea that you can send messages, that you should send messages by slaughtering people, is common to people with many different ideologies. And he mentions among them not only McNamara, but Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush.
You're listening to WSCA LP 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. My name's Tom Jackson, and I am talking with Norman Solomon. His new book is called War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. The final chapter in your book is called Withdrawal Would Cripple U.S. Credibility. And it seems to me that that, perhaps more than any other mantra, if you want to call it that, has been used over the last several months. And one can certainly hear not only Bush administration officials and Republicans, but also many Democrats have been saying that for quite some time.
Yes, this is very much where we are politically in terms of the Iraq war when it comes to mainstream media and politics on Capitol Hill. And almost invariably, and it's certainly the case now, the public is ahead of the politicians and what's been called the punditocracy. If you look at the polls, about a third of the U.S. population wants immediate, complete withdrawal of U.S. troops. And quite a lot of others at least want such a process to begin immediately. But when you look on Capitol Hill, you find very few members of Congress who are willing to speak, especially in the Senate, where there's more of a capability to get a high-profile media response. There's more of a capability through the filibuster to actually impede war appropriations. You have very few members of the Senate willing to come close to demanding immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Iraq. And yet, you look at the Vietnam parallels, they're quite chilling. And the U.S. troops can come out now or they can come out later. If they come out later, there will be really nothing accomplished but more killing.
I wanted to also have you talk for a few minutes, if you would, about you're the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. And I guess I'm wondering, given what we were saying before about how so much of what you talk about in War Made Easy is not really new stuff. You go back, you know, for several administrations and really point out how it's been kind of going this way for quite some time. Is the work of the Institute for Public Accuracy more intense, I guess would be a word for it, post 9/11 or since the Bush administration has come into power? Or is that, again, something that isn't all that different?
Well, I think that our basic task is the same, but it has become more intense in the last few years, largely because we are in a permanent warfare state now, and the Bush administration has made good on a promise that was made in the form of an op-ed piece in the New York Times 16 days after 9/11, a piece by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, where essentially he did promise a war without end, a perpetual war with no exit strategies, no timelines. And that has meant at the Institute for Public Accuracy, which was founded partway through the second term of President Bill Clinton, that we need to come very much to terms with the militarization of not only U.S. foreign policy, but of the domestic policy as well, what is done to our budgets, the militarism in the rhetoric, and what we are confronting in terms of the political economy and the priorities that are reflected in the federal budget with so many damaging effects domestically. So we were very much, as an organization, challenging a lot of the assumptions of the Clinton administration, the war in Yugoslavia, the bombing that went on for 78 straight days. As you know from reading my book, I talk in there about something that the Institute for Public Accuracy was one of the few organizations to raise with literally thousands of media outlets to very little effect, and that was the manipulation of the Rambouillet talks prior to the beginning of the U.S. bombing of Yugoslavia in early 1999. And so we were swimming upstream then and challenging a lot of what was accepted and supported by the Democratic Party. But since 9/11, we've had really had to challenge a lot about the way in which the meaning of 9/11 has been framed and the way in which U.S. military actions since then have been rationalized by the White House and by much of the press.
Going back to one more of the chapters in your book, War Made Easy. Chapter 5 is called This is About Human Rights, and in a certain sense, especially when it's applied to the response from supporters of a continued occupation of Iraq, you know, when they're challenged about that, quite often what I'm hearing is about that this is about human rights, or with the term democracy almost used interchangeably, that this is all about bringing democracy to that region. Talk to us about that and what your perception of what is happening really in Iraq today.
Well, I'd be all for a foreign policy based on human rights if there were consistency there. And so when we're told that it was necessary to go to war on Iraq because it was a horrific regime that tortured its citizens, which is certainly true, it was horrific, it did engage in torture, then why is the U.S., for instance, giving a couple of $1 billion a year to the Egyptian government, which routinely tortures its political prisoners, of which it has an appreciable amount? These are questions that simply are not raised in the U.S. news media, and I think the answers that have to do with just a fundamental hypocrisy, that U.S. foreign policy is not based on a regard for human rights. It's oblivious to human rights. It uses human rights as an argument when there are other policy goals to be implemented by what's called diplomacy or by warfare, by economic strangulation or whatever. But we really have no way to make a case that there's a human rights theme played out with any consistency in U.S. foreign policy. And in point of fact, since 9/11, and I quote the Secretary General of Amnesty International, Irene Khan, to this effect in the book, what has happened is that Washington has promoted abuses of human rights to an extreme around the world. Through example, you know, what happened with Guantanamo Bay prisoners and continues to happen there, with the U.S. publicly thumbing its nose at Geneva Conventions and asserting their right, which continues to this moment, to torture prisoners of the U.S. government. This is a way that then winks and nods and gives license to regimes like the Putin government in Russia to engage in their own so-called war on terror, which actually is continuation in Chechnya of simply a war where the central government is willing to kill large numbers of people for its own purposes.
Well, one question that comes to mind, and this is something that in the past I've had to sort of deal with myself, when a concerned citizen, someone who's concerned about what the U.S. foreign policy is and how accurate is the information we're getting from mainstream media, is there a perpetuation of myths, lies, and half-truths, and so on, it can be overwhelming, not only in terms of sort of facing the Goliath of the military industrial complex, but one could certainly add media to that complex nowadays. It's just an endless barrage of information that is often at best questionable. And one could certainly employ lots of people to respond to all of that information full-time, 24/7. What do you have for suggestions for people who are concerned and, you know, maybe at some point have felt ready to just toss their hands up and say, forget about it, you know, there's nothing I can do about it? What can people do to counter this military-industrial media complex?
Well, as discouraging as things can be right now, things would be worse if people weren't organizing, if we didn't have low-power radio and community radio and websites and independent print outlets and video makers and writers and others who are simply saying that we do not accept the militarization of our society and that we're going to continue to dig for information and to share it with as many people as we can, and to build social movements that challenge what Martin Luther King called the madness of militarism. This is obviously sometimes an overwhelming task to even contemplate, and no one person can do a whole heck of a lot. But there is a movement underway, and it's flawed. It has a lot of weaknesses. There are a lot of fractionations of it. But there is a peace and social justice movement, or movements, if you will. It ties into the labor movement, environmental movement, civil rights movement, the struggle for civil liberties. It has many fronts, many avenues, from lobbying to civil disobedience to public demonstrations to educational campaigns and all the rest of it. The electoral arena, clearly very important as well. And the alternative to challenging this horrendous status quo is to be passive, to be consuming history instead of trying to constructively affect it. I think that is the more discouraging possibility. That option is guaranteed to be a disaster. And so even though, as I say, there are many reasons to be discouraged, I very much identify with something that Antonio Gramsci wrote when he was imprisoned under Mussolini. He talked about the need of pessimism for the intellect and optimism of the will. And I think that while we have many reasons to be pessimistic, there is the will, the determination that people have had throughout the course of human history, and we certainly have it today, to say we're not going to give up and we're going to create positive change.
Norman Solomon's new book is called War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman, I know you've been doing some touring, including a little bit of touring on the West Coast with David Rovics recently. How's the touring been? And how's the response been?
Well, it was very encouraging to go from one community to another, often small towns or medium-sized cities, up from San Francisco to Arcata and Rohnert Park and Eugene and Grass Valley, and towns where people are quite active. Often there's a community radio station and or some independent weekly or monthly print publications. And David Rovics is such a terrific songwriter and musician and singer, and really energized people. And so I found that encouraging, that just about anywhere you go in the country, if you look for it, you'll find people who are active in social justice work.
And Norman Solomon will be coming to the New England area, including New Hampshire Peace Action's annual dinner, which is Friday, November 11th at the Concord High School on Pleasant Street in Concord. And the lineup for that is silent auction and fellowship at 5 o'clock, dinner at 6 o'clock, and then Norman Solomon gives the keynote address at 7:15 p.m. Tell us where else you're going to be in the upcoming Northeast tour.
Well, a fair amount of travel. I'm going to be in Rutland, Vermont, and the sponsors of the event in Concord are in touch with the folks up in Vermont. That's going to be the following night, Saturday night, the 12th. And then I'll be in Providence, it looks like, the night of the 13th, the Sunday night, and that's being sponsored by the Green City Council member, David Siegel. So anybody down that way in Providence, can get hold of David Siegel's office and get the details. I should say, too, that there's info about what I've been up to and the War Made Easy book at the site warmadeeasy.com. And for good measure, we were talking about the Institute for Public Accuracy. We have more than 1,000 news releases that we've put out in the last 8 years posted and archived permanently on our site, which is accuracy.org.
And I know you're also published frequently on many different websites, including commondreams.org. And where else? So how about MediaBeat?
Well, my column is out on a number of sites, including it's archived at normansolomon.com. Truthout.org often has my stuff up there. The Media Watch Group Fair site also has my column there, which is fair.org. And that in its own right, we're talking about the military-industrial media complex. Fair is a very important organization, I believe, to challenge media spin and corporate power through information flow. And I'd urge anybody who would like to be more active on media issues, make a habit of going to the FAIR site. It's fair.org. And among other things, you can sign up to get on its media activism list, which now has about 80,000 people, for action alerts.
Norman Solomon's new book is called War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hey, thank you.